Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Jonathan Xavier, inasmuch as you insist on being an outsider and laughing at the rules and traditions of our advanced civilization, I am exiling you to a place which has no adherence to either. I have no choice but to sentence you to Earth.
That interlude.
I've been in that godforsaken desert for 40 days and 40 nights, all to get away from Johnny and his pack of jackals.
Where is she?
What's up with Johnny? What's he waiting for?
We've seen planet Earth for what it's worth, but there's other planets to explore.
Flying saucer.
Mickey O'Flynn, the man with the grin, is missing.
Oh, my God. I might just faint.
I want to tell the whole world that I'm alive.
How do you think you came back?
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White.
And I'm Rob St. Mary.
This week we're talking about The Ghastly Love of Johnny X, a brand spanking new film from Paul Bunnell. The film stars Will Keenan as the titular Johnny X. He's a juvenile delinquent from outer space. He's banished to Earth for being a no-goodnik, but luckily for him, he comes to our planet with a very handy resurrection suit that allows him to bring folks back from the dead and do some other nifty stuff. The film has a real rock and roll bent. Two of the major characters in the film include Reggie Bannister as King Clayton, a slightly dishonest promoter, is there any other kind, and Creed Bratton as Mickey O'Flynn, the man with the grin, and now recently deceased, a rock star. So, all right, Rob, did you find Johnny X to be ghastly or great?
Well, I want to get this out on top. I think it's a very, very good film. But I don't think it's great. I think that it needs about 10 minutes taken out. I think that if the editing was a little bit tighter, the storytelling was a little bit tighter, and it moved just a little bit faster, it would be ghastly great. Beyond that, though, I think that in terms of performances, the look of this thing, the ideas, there's so much stuff going on. It's such a beautiful film to look at. One thing that's really nice about it is that it has that 1950s juvenile delinquent film vibe, but it's not a parody or a spoof of said films.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. It looks absolutely gorgeous. The black and white cinematography is great. When Johnny's got his resurrection suit on, just the whites against the blacks and everything just looks really, really nice. I think it's also a very good film. The one criticism I have is the Sluggo character, where he's so not in the film until a certain point, and then he's in the film continuously after that. And I rewatched the film last night, actually, and I was just like, I'm looking for Sluggo. And I see him in the back, and he gets a line here and there in one of the songs. And we should say up front that this is a musical as well.
Yeah, I think it's a rather good musical, too. As you were talking about the Sluggo character, I think maybe this is an issue that as we know from the interview and some of our reading is that it was a movie that was made over a relatively long period of time.
That's true. So I don't know if they really knew going in what was going to happen or if they got the coverage that they needed, that kind of stuff. But I mean, Sluggo's there in the first song and he's there in the background a little bit, but there's that What's Up With Johnny song, which is very pivotal to the film, at least to me. And he's there, but he's very much in the background. He's not singing. I don't know if maybe Sluggo wasn't the greatest singer in the world or something, but I mean, he's a great character once it kind of comes out of his shell, but just that you don't see him as much as you go through it. I agree, could be a little bit tighter. I really got a lot more out of subsequent viewings, I have to say. The first time I watched it, I was like, yeah, this is pretty good. Second time I watched it, I was like, okay, there is a lot of stuff going on in this film, you know, just the relationships, you know, who's related to who, who's been going out with who. Not to say that I didn't get that the first time, because I am not completely stupid, but I didn't get all of that kind of stuff the first time through. It really kind of resonated a lot more on second and third viewing.
And I think that ultimately that's the thing that's really nice about it, is that it has the ability to hold up on the viewings. The music is very catchy. It's very well done. And it's not really, it's not derivative in that, you know, it's tonally, much like we were talking about with Grace of My Heart, it's of the era, but it doesn't really echo any particular song. It's not like they're saying, okay, well, this song is this song, and we're just going to sort of strip out the lyrics and put something new in it.
See this A. It's an A for an S.
Oh, man.
Do you like my A?
Uh-huh.
Well, look at it and like it, because it's all that you get.
They went in and they really gave the film, in terms of its music, not only the musical songs, but the score pieces, its own real flavor that is sort of steeped in that 1950s sound. So it, I think they're to be commended in terms of the overall tonality of the music, how it fits into the plot structure of the film. So I'm a big fan of this. As a matter of fact, I'm wondering if they're deciding to put out some sort of soundtrack record on this.
Definitely hope they do, because that Green-Eyed Monster song that Mickey O'Flynn, the man with the grin, sings, I really like that song.
I'm like a big green-eyed monster.
And I really do like What's Up With Johnny. That one kind of sticks in my head long after I'm done watching the film. And, you know, hearing it again, rewatching it, I was just like, yeah, this is really, you know, quite a good song. And it goes on for a long time. It's not like, and I should probably say too, I mean, there's so many different flavors of musical. There's like the Evita type of musical where nothing really is spoken. And then there's the Rocky Horror type of musical where you, every once in a while, you get a song and it kind of propels the narrative along. This is kind of like that, but just a little bit more pared back, because there aren't constant songs. You know, the songs come when they should, and it's not like they're kind of forcing these things in there, and it's not like one of these kind of Oklahoma things where it's like, you know, oh, you want me to tell you about that? Well, and the orchestra swells up. So I think they did a good job of mixing the way that the songs come in with the actual narrative. And you're right, the songs fit with that kind of 50s aesthetic, though it's kind of a weird thing, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit later on too, about that this is kind of almost like an alternate version of Earth. It's not it's not today. It's not the 1950s. It's maybe today on, you know, I don't know my DC universe too well, but it's like today on Earth 33 or something.
It's like Bizarro World.
Maybe Bizarro World, but people don't say goodbye when they show up and then hello when they leave. But
you know, one of the things that's really nice in terms of hitting that tonality, obviously, is the music, but the design and that black and white cinematography, their idea to go with that, I think was a real risk. You have all of these things that you're trying to do as an independent filmmaker. You're trying to make a movie that would be commercially viable to some extent. And it's like, there's not a lot of black and white movies that are made. And to decide to make a black and white film really is a standout thing. But to shoot it in such a way, it's so good. It's not that it has almost this sort of documentary feel. This, I'd have to say, is very lush. It's almost the equivalent of like Tim Burton's Ed Wood. It looks like it was the same guy that shot it. And just really kind of creamy look in the skin, nice black and white look. And I was just really impressed with it sort of across the board, at least in terms of the visual style with the cinematography.
The other thing is that it really makes people, you know, look good. I mean, I don't know how attractive these people are in real life or not, but man, oh man, they just all look so good in this film. And this doesn't look like one of those, you know, we shot it in color and sapped the color later on. It feels like this was actually shot in, you know, with a black and white stock and film rather than, you know, any kind of just digital trickery, which is, again, very risky for a filmmaker in this day and age to do. I mean, you know, there's the cost of the film itself. There's screwed up takes where you can't use it, all that kind of stuff that we talked to the Superb Man guys about. But, you know, this is probably one of the last ones that we'll get. In fact, I think that the film stock that this was shot on was discontinued while they were shooting it. And the filmmaker had to go out and just snatch up as much of the Kodak stock as he possibly could, which is kind of sad.
You know, what's funny is you talk about how they all look really good in black and white. Sort of reminds me of the introduction that's on the front of The Third Man, where they interview Peter Bogdanovich. And obviously, he was a guy who hung out with Orson Welles. And Bogdanovich, I remember, says in this interview, he goes, Orson always used to talk about black and white as being the actor's friend. He's like, name me. He's like, Orson used to say, name me a great performance in color. He's like, you can't do it. He's like, you can't do it. He goes, black and white is the actor's friend. So it's maybe old Orson, who's been gone now over 25 years, maybe has something on that. So I don't know.
You can't say in July. Name me a sentence that begins with in July. Yeah, everyone looks great. The women in this are really looking good. And though the main woman sometimes looks a little scary, sometimes looks fantastic. So it just depends on, I guess, kind of the angle with that.
The actors in this are great. I mean, Will Keenan, I'm going to put on the record right now, just to let you know in advance, if I do have any bias on Will Keenan, I did give him some money for a film he did a few years ago. So I was an investor in one of his earlier films. But I met Will Keenan through, obviously, through Troma, because Troma put out one of my movies. And when I saw him with, like, Tromeo, which we're going to talk about a few episodes down the road, I was like, this guy is really good. I mean, and that was like his first starring role. And I've seen a lot of the stuff. I mean, obviously he's done a lot of things, but it's like, I've seen a lot of the stuff that he's done and really always impressed with him. And he's a guy that can really do humor, but not be over the top with it. Like, it's just gesture and look and line deliveries and stuff like that.
What should we do, boss? Should we make him talk? Knock his block, clean his clock?
Get cool, Polly. If this fine, upstanding citizen and his fine, upstanding wife?
Girlfriend.
Whatever. Have anything to tell us, I'm sure that's exactly what they're gonna do. Right?
That's right, super duper daddy-o.
So, where is she?
One thing that they don't bring out in Johnny X, that's one of Will's strong suits, is his physicality. For a while, he wanted to do a biopic. He was talking about doing a biopic of Buster Keaton, in which he was going to play Buster Keaton. And he's probably the only guy that I could think of that might be able to pull off all the stunts like that. Because if you see some of his work that he does in other films, the guy can throw himself around and you're amazed you can walk away from it.
I've never met the man, but he is very cute on film, I will say. And he looks, I mean, does he have a painting somewhere that's just looking worse and worse as the days go on? Because he looks exactly the same, to me at least, as he did in Tromeo.
He must preserve himself or something. I have no idea. You know, but the thing that's great about Will in this is Johnny X is that he has that look. He has that look of that sort of what we would consider from those 1950s films, from those juvenile delinquent films, that really, you know, dark haired, leather jacketed, greaser look. I'd have to say, though, you know, in terms of that image, that it sits really well sort of like on the shelf of that look when you talk about maybe a character like the Fonz or like a Danny Zuko from Grease. He kind of fits in there where it's like, you know, if Johnny X was hanging out with either of those guys, he'd fit right in.
Yeah, and look out. Those guys will kick your ass. Yeah, the one thing I'm curious, what's your opinion as far as the soda jerk character?
I thought the soda jerk character was interesting. Offhand, his name is Chip in the film. And I thought it was a good counterpoint. You know, it plays into a lot of the stuff that you see in those 50s films about sort of like teenage love and sort of like the two guys competing for the girl and all that stuff. I thought he did a really nice job with it and sort of has to play the straight man quite a bit, because the girl who plays Bliss, who's Johnny X's girlfriend, she is really good in terms of her line delivery and her presence and the way that she sort of has this like sex kitten persona. You need someone who can play against that really well, and I think he does an awesome job with it.
Yeah, their scenes together are terrific, and yeah, I love all of her double entendres.
What can I get you?
Make it cold and wet, handsome.
A pop?
With the twist of lime? Chip, my name is Bliss. Repeat it.
Bliss.
That's nice. I like the way you say that. Let's try another one. You see that desert?
Yeah, I see it.
You know what's sitting out there?
No. What?
Lizards.
Lizards?
That's right. A whole bunch of lizards. Do you know what those lizards are doing? They're looking for me, that's what they're doing. And you know why? They want to lick me.
Lick you? You mean...
Doesn't matter. Well, that does matter. You are no lizard, and you don't remind me of him.
And it's a very well-written film, too. You know, I was complaining earlier about the lack of Sluggo, but as far as, like, the lines and everything, I mean, there are some very quotable lines in this thing, stuff that I'm probably going to pick up and use myself as far as, you know, the party doesn't start until you see the whites of their thighs. Yeah, very good line.
Some of the great sort of casting, but, you know, some of the folks who came in, you know, day players, little cameos and stuff like that. It is really great in Johnny X because it starts with, for me, a guy, totally underappreciated character actor, Kevin McCarthy. And not only that, but this is a guy who then echoes back to that 1950s because he was the star of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So, I mean, what more could you want, you know, in that, to have him leading this tribunal in the beginning of the film that decides to send Johnny X and his friends to Earth because, of course, they're just undisciplined and they're horrible, irreverent people who will not conform to the society in which they've created.
Do you really wish to become that? Undisciplined, irreverent, tasteless. I'd like to advise you to choose your next words carefully, because this may be your last chance to find grace among your own people.
So it was just a pleasure to see him.
He is always a favorite. I'm a huge fan of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I don't mind the I very much like the Philip Kaufman remake. Not too much of a fan of the Abel Ferrara remake, but I do very much enjoy those first two. But yeah, he was always so great. I mean, I loved him, especially in like UHF. He was great in that too. I mean, anytime he showed up in a movie, you knew you were in for a treat. And then it was also nice, too, to see a small part from Paul Williams.
Yeah, and you're a huge Paul Williams fan, so I'm going to let you go off about Paul Williams' cousin Quilty, the talk show host.
Yeah, they're out there traveling along. You've got Mickey O'Flynn and Sluggo and that kind of, I don't know how to describe that kind of Earth child girl who's very sexualized, but, you know, still pretty, let's say, innocent. But anyway, they're out traveling around past midnight, and they decide to drop in on Uncle Quilty. And yeah, Paul Williams, great to see. He is looking very nice in this film as well, and just kind of put on a really hamming it up.
Are you brain damaged or drunk? We're on the air. Where are we working tomorrow?
Ooh,
This is a nice surprise.
Oh, no, don't tell me. Let me guess. The Martians have landed.
Oh, it's better than that.
Better than Martians?
I have to tell you, folks, there have been a lot of weird rumors circulating about this man. Tabloids have been reporting that he's dropped dead or disappeared or even worse. But evidently nothing could keep him away from Cousin Quilty's show tonight. Put your hands together, ladies and gentlemen, for one of the greatest singers of all time. The man with a grin, Mickey O'Flynn.
The one thing about the Paul Williams character that I thought was kind of interesting is, it's like you said, a talk show that starts at midnight. To me, it kind of reminded me like maybe like they got the idea from like Art Bell, because Art Bell used to have this radio program that was always on and like overnights on AM radio. And he would talk about aliens and all kinds of, you know, Bigfoot sightings and stuff like that. And that's what they're kind of talking about. Like there's this gal who's on the show and she's kind of talking about, oh, well, like abductions and stuff like that. And he's like, oh, yeah, I know. It's like they tried to abduct me. And it's great to see him. I mean, he's just, you know, great actor, obviously an amazing songwriter and performer in his own right, going back to when you guys did the episode on The Phantom of the Paradise. And just in terms of his output as a musician, as a songwriter, it's quite incredible. And I know he's long been a hero of yours, someone you've really enjoyed.
Yeah, definitely. You know, God, I can't believe you threw out Art Bell. That was great to hear. I used to, every once in a while, people would come into where I was working and be like, did you hear this on Art Bell? Did you hear about this? And so, yeah, it was great. Good comparison.
Well, I mean, you know, he was one of those presents on broadcasting for like 20 years. So, I mean, when I first started in radio, when I started on the commercial band and talk radio in the newsroom, he was on. I would roll in, you know, to do the morning shift and catch the end of Art Bell. And I didn't necessarily agree that there were werewolves and, you know, aliens, but he always made it entertaining nonetheless.
Yeah, definitely. And he was a big fan of Tesla, which I like a lot, too. Not the band, but the actual inventor.
What, there was a band that Nikola Tesla was in?
Nikola Tesla, he played the bass. So he used to make some really funny looking faces.
Of course. Because that's the very sexy position for any up and coming musician, is to play the bass.
Exactly.
We're going to take a break and we'll be right back with an interview that Mike and I did with director Paul Bunnell and star Reggie Bannister.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Johnny, oh Johnny, why can't you Johnny be good? Behave a bit more normal, like an earthly teenager should.
I got the idea from a bunch of different movies that I was watching in the late 90s, and I had kind of wanted to do something based on the kind of sci-fi juvenile delinquents films, you know, the lower budget sci-fi films, but not in a spoofy way. I wanted to do something just kind of fun, and as if I were doing one of those sorts of films today, contemporary, yet it had some of the sensibilities of the 1950s and stuff in there. with the cars and the costumes and that sort of thing. Originally, it was just going to be the gang themselves were going to be the 1950s-looking gang, and everything else was going to be modern and contemporary. But I ended up going kind of with a look to the whole movie that has sort of a 1950s, 60s look, and sprinkled a little bit of 70s in there as well. Although the film does not take place in any of those time periods, it takes place kind of in a today alternate reality sort of thing. But nobody seems to get that, including the cast members. So I guess I either did my job or didn't do my job, but it really doesn't matter when it takes place. Well, it's funny because I had a question from the audience. I think it was on the premiere night. I did three screenings of Cinequest, and someone asked the question, were you intentionally putting a digital camera in the movie as kind of a, inside joke? And I thought, well, no, because the movie takes place basically today, and I don't think anybody gets that. So, guys, Mike and Rob, what did you get that impression?
Well, I think the black and white kind of lends to an older feel, but for me, it kind of lived in that same world where, like, a Edward Scissorhands lived.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you got it, exactly, right. And, you know, the black and white thing wasn't done really to make it feel like an old movie, because I've done black and white before, and I just kind of like black and white. You know, it just seemed like the right way to go with this project. And I had never done 35 millimeter widescreen black and white, you know, anamorphic, which a couple of my favorite films from the period in the 70s, Manhattan by Woody Allen was shot that way, and also The Elephant Man by David Lynch. And I really, and a lot of great older films too, but, you know, I loved the look of that, and I'd always wanted to do it. I'd done the regular, smaller screen black and white, but I thought this would be great, you know, to do this widescreen black and white and kind of bring that back. So I did it, and I love shooting it that way because black and white to me makes you get lost in a dream and you feel like you're not in reality. You're removed from the color, which is a distraction to me sometimes. And, you know, I just think black and white is a beautiful thing. It really is.
How were you able to get it made? I mean, I'm sure people weren't running in your direction to hand you fistfuls of cash to try and make this kind of movie, especially in black and white, because it seems like something that wouldn't go over too well with commercial audiences.
Well, if Reggie, I think Reggie would recall this, he and I and a few others went out to Hollywood Boulevard and carried signs around and preached, "The end is near, please donate to this film." No, I
remember that. Yeah, I brought my guitar, didn't I?
Yeah, right.
A little bit, some gospel stuff, rolling down the road with Jesus. And
No, and I'm sure that Reggie could tell you that getting a film financed is no easy thing, especially when you're looking for, bigger money, because, Reggie and his wife Gigi have produced a number of things, and, I've been making movies since I was a kid, going back to 1974, just dating myself there. Not that I want to date myself. Who'd want to date me, other than dating, you know. But, no, I got the money through basically just the way I've always done it.
You robbed a bank, right?
Yeah, I robbed a bank. As a matter of fact, there was a Bank of America right down the street from my house, so we were tunneling.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's right. I was tunneling under the street, and for 6 years I was waiting to get to that bank vault, and that's why it took us that long to finish the film,
It was a long tunnel, yeah.
But, no, it was self-financed. We had no outside interference. I had tried just about every company at the time. But my wife and I started the picture with some money that we had, and we also borrowed a little additional money against our house. And then we realized it was going to be a little bit more expensive to make the picture than we thought. So we went ahead and sort of put the thing on hold until we can raise some more money. And we cut a really neat production teaser. And, we just had no luck. I had a lot of companies saying, "Oh, this looks great. Call us when you get it done. We'd love to see it." But they wouldn't put up any money. So 6 years later, when I'm just about at the end of my rope and four nervous breakdowns later, I decided that I was about ready to hang it up. I thought, well, the guy with the stick-to-itivity, I don't know even if I can get this thing done, But finally, an old friend of mine came forward, and he was in a position to help and said, I'm going to help you finish this thing. And thank goodness he did. So he gave us the money to finish the film. And, well, I'm just ever so grateful. And his name is Mark Willoughby. And if he's listening, sorry, I didn't mean to reveal your identity. Yeah.
So 6 years, what was going on during that whole time? And how do you keep a cast together during that whole period?
Well, you know, I don't know. Reggie, I knew Reggie was always good to go, but some of the other ones were sort of like kind of going off in different directions. And I would just keep calling everyone when I thought it was getting close and say, hey, how you guys doing? You know, how's your hair? You know, your hair is still the same. You know, you losing any weight? Are you gaining any weight? You know, so I would just kind of keep everybody in the loop. And even Will Keenan admitted to me that he thought that after the first year, he thought, oh, this can happen. And the second year, by the time the third year rolled around, he said he just humored me every time I called. He said, you know, this to himself, this isn't going to happen. And he just humored me and wished me the best and never thought in his wildest dreams that he would be finishing the movie. But we did, and I think I surprised everyone there. Reggie, what would you say about that?
Well, for me, Paul, and you guys, I've known Paul for a lot of years, and the first project that we did together was a project that he came to me with called That Little Monster.
Yeah.
And shot that in black and white, and that was just a priceless little piece of greatness, really, brilliance. And so I was down with Paul, and I knew his stick-to-itiveness was going to get this done. And I know it sounds far out, you guys, 6 years. But it just seemed kind of natural when he finally called me up and said, hey, guess what, we're going to finish this thing. I went, you know, bitchin', let's do it, you know. What was amazing to me about it was when we all got together, all the cast and stuff, that everybody that needed to look like it was yesterday when we started, they all looked the same.
You guys all looked the same.
Isn't that weird?
I thought that, you know, when I got back on that set 6 years later, I thought that I was doing season six of like a series with the same characters, and it was the most bizarre feeling.
I know. It was really odd.
But to have everybody back.
Yeah.
And their costumes fit. We didn't need any alterations.
It's that far out. Wow.
You know, I mean, talk about, you know, I was the only one that aged, really. I mean, you know, I was...
But you aged very well.
I aged well, like a fine cheese, you know.
Yeah. Don't they get smellier? I don't know.
A Limburger, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was going to ask on inspirations. One thing, especially in that diner scene where you have the song and dance number near the front, it moves from sort of a reality scene to sort of this like symbolic staging where you have these set pieces. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of like the Forbidden Zone. So were you inspired by that?
It's so funny you should say that because, I mean, yes and no. I mean, Richard Elfman, the director of The Forbidden Zone, went to my cast and crew screening at Universal. And he saw the movie, and Ego Plum, who did the score, turned and asked Richard, does this look familiar to you? And Richard just hunched his shoulders like, huh, what? No, he didn't really get what Ego was trying to say. In other words, this is like The Forbidden Zone, you know, with these cardboard sets and everything. But, you know, I love The Forbidden Zone. It's a neat movie, and I may have been just, you know, 10% inspired, you know, by that. But I had always wanted to do a fantasy diner sequence that was going to be a little bit more of like German expressionism, you know, and something a little darker and weirder. But we turned out that we ended up making it bright and very, very simplistic. To be quite honest with you, I wasn't really thrilled with the set. Although it was a little lackluster for me, but I worked with it, you know. You know, I thought there was going to be a little bit more to it. I had these footprints. Anyway, it just turned out to be what it was. And I'm glad you guys like it, you know. I mean, it is kind of a fun sequence in the movie. You know, I didn't really want to rip off anyone or take anyone else's ideas. I was hoping to make a movie that would be 100% original, something you really haven't seen before, or maybe it feels like maybe you have. And the one thing that I think is a misconception is that people or some folks are trying to project that this is something like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but I'm here to say not only did I not care for that movie, but this is nothing like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I mean, would you agree, Reggie? I mean, that's its own thing, and I wouldn't really compare it with that, you know.
Well, I think you know, only in the absolute broadest terms, and I'm not even sure what those terms would be. This the story is completely different. It's very unique. And I think you did what you set out to do, Paul, and I think everybody pretty much agrees. Mike, Rob, I think you agree it's an incredibly unique film and an incredibly unique film experience. I don't think it looks like anything I've ever seen before.
It's got a very nice look to it and everything, and Reggie, when I think of you, I don't normally think of you kind of belting out, you know, the big show tunes and everything. How was that? I mean, have you sung on film before?
Well, yeah, you know, I've been a musician all my life, I usually describe it as being blessed with two curses, or vice versa, cursed with two blessings. Music and theater, film, acting. But when I started off when I was 15, I auditioned for a group called the Young Americans, which was a very much of a show group. And now they're just having their 50th anniversary this month, I think, or next month, I can't remember. Very kind of showy kind of a group. And then I was in the Greenwood County Singers, and we did a lot of variety show stuff, TV show stuff. And in between, like when I was a kid, I did a couple of musicals as well. So I was really down with this. And what's interesting, though, you guys, about a musician, I've made a lot of albums as well, a musician doing a character, or, you know, singing a character in a film or in the theater, is that you want to sing it like that character, and you don't want to sing it like you normally would sing your own stuff, if you know what I mean. And so when you see it back, you go, wow, that's really kind of far out, because that's King Clayton singing that.
Yeah, you definitely did a character take on it.
Yeah, and that's not me. That's not the way Reg sings. So it's really interesting from that standpoint. And I think probably every musical actor feels that way about their performances.
Yeah, and I knew Reggie's musical background, of course, and if you've seen the original Phantasm, you see them doing this little number with their guitars, and I think that was something you guys improvised, right, Reggie?
Yeah, it was, Sitting Here at Midnight. That was actually Bill Thornberry's idea for a song, and he had just come up with it like something like the night before. We needed about 30 seconds of stuff in that spot, and they had already shot me at my ice cream parlor in Phantasm doing a bunch of songs, so I thought, my own, and I thought, well, gee, I'll be terribly gracious, and so I won't do my song in here. Well, you know, ask Bill, you know, if he has a song that he can put in the movie.
So there's a great answer to your question. I mean, yeah, I mean, Reggie definitely has the musical background, and I knew that, so... But, you know, interestingly, you know, the movie project itself was not started as a musical. I knew there was the character of Mickey O'Flynn, who was going to sing a couple of songs in concert or whatever. And then one day, when I wasn't really happy with the way the script was progressing, I looked at one of the scenes and I said, you know, all this stuff in the diner, it goes on and on and on and on. Why don't we just throw in a musical number here to end all musical numbers? And that's what that whole diner, fantasy diner thing is. And actually, the musical number is a little bit longer than what ends up in the movie. I did trim it down a little bit because I felt it went on too long. But once we started adding other musical numbers, we needed to balance that out. But we loved it so much that we kept on doing that, and we added five or six songs. And so now, technically, Johnny X, I that's why I jokingly say the movie is not a musical, but I guess it sort of is. It's not an out, you know, it's not a song every 5 minute kind of thing, but we don't use the rockabilly tunes. We use more of a West Side Story kind of a take on songs.
Looking at the casting a little bit, we already talked a little bit about Will Keenan. How did you come across him and then decide to put him in as your lead?
Well, I had known the look that I wanted for the character, and Ramsey Abed is one of my associate producers, a fellow I met recently at the time, and he referred me. He kept giving me names for different people to be different things, and one of them was Eagle Plum, the guy to do the music, and I'd been working with a guy for many, many years doing stuff, and I kind of wanted to broaden my horizons and get some new people, so I met with Ego, and I thought he was so interesting and sort of had my sensibilities that I hired him, thanks to Ramsey, and then he referred me to this guy named Will Keenan. Well, honestly, I'd never heard of him, and well, that doesn't mean anything. I wasn't too familiar with Creed Bratton before either. But so I checked out his reel, Will Keenan's reel, and I thought, well, he kind of looks like he could be the character, and he's sort of funny, although I was going for more of a quiet, you know, sort of tormented character in Johnny X. But I met with him, and he was great. You know, he wanted to do it, and I thought he would be cool. I originally wanted the character to smoke cigarettes, but Will Keenan did not want to smoke and put that role model out there, so I came up with the black liquor sticks that Johnny X pulls out every now and again instead of cigarettes. So that actually kind of adds a fun little dimension. But yeah, he was basically, met him through Ramsey Abed. All my casting was sort of, for the most part, people that I had met. I did have a casting call, and I got a casting director named Pam Gillis involved a little bit later, and she cast Creed Bratton and Kate Maberly, but everybody else was pretty much cast by me, including Kevin McCarthy, Paul Williams, Reggie, and all those other folks.
And Kevin McCarthy is just such a great character actor who's like all over the place. And
oh yeah, I wanted him in the movie for sure.
And I understand this is his final role. I mean, can you kind of tell me how you got to know him and how you got into the piece?
Yeah, it turned out to be his final released film. I met Kevin at a film festival that I attend every year in Hollywood called CineCon, that's held at the Egyptian Theater, and Kevin was a guest, and they were running a couple of his movies, not the typical ones you would expect, like Body Snatchers, but they were running a picture called Nightmare, which was made in 1956 with Edward G. Robinson. It was a noir film, and I thought this was just fantastic, you know, and boy, here's Kevin McCarthy, and I'd seen him around town, you know, in the past and stuff, and seen him in, you know, more recent movies that Joe Dante was directing. And I approached him and asked him if he was still acting, and he said yes, and asked if he would be interested in taking a look at a script, and he said yes, and so he gave me his number, and it just was that simple, you know, and then he told me no, and then he told me yes, and then he told me no, and then he told me yes, so he waffled a little bit, but ultimately he was great to work with, and it was really cool to have him in the movie. And that's kind of a similar way how I met Paul Williams. I met Paul. I'd always been a big fan of his. I went to a screening of Phantom of the Paradise that Paul was going to be at, and I approached Paul after the thing, and I said, you know, are you still doing acting? Yes, you know, well, I've got something. I'd love to. So he gave me his email address right there. You know, he took me aside, and he told me it, and I contacted him, and it kind of went from there, you know, and it took a lot of coaxing to get Paul Williams on board, because I think he's a very picky person about what he does, and you know, it was really very difficult to you know, originally he was supposed to play Mickey O'Flynn, and then he got a little busy once we got our money, and I had to recast. Paul was out as Mickey, and he really didn't want to play Cousin Quilty, but I kept calling, and I said, is there any way, you know, and he said, okay, we'll do it. He just couldn't say no. He loved the project, so we got him on board, and we got Creed Bratton as Mickey, and it all worked out just, you know, swimmingly.
So you give Paul Williams one of the few non-singing roles in the film, huh?
I know. Well, you see, that's the whole thing. Originally, he was going to play the guy, the Mickey O'Flynn, and he was going to be singing, and I was even considering maybe asking him to write a couple of songs, which would have cost us some money. But, you know, the problem was Paul got real busy with being the president of ASCAP. And once that happened, he's so darn busy, he barely has a free day to himself. So it wasn't a question that he didn't really want to play Cousin Quilty. It was just that he had no time. He couldn't find a day in the schedule when we were shooting. But miraculously, a day opened up, so I was able to get him to shoot the Cousin Quilty role. And I was so thrilled because I'd really always wanted to work with him and to give him something a little bigger than just a cameo role. And he's in the movie after all, so it's just thrilling to have him there. And he took me aside afterwards and he said, you know, you made a great choice with Creed Bratton. He's going to be great as Mickey O'Flynn. So, you know, he gave his thumbs up to that.
Were there any challenges that you know, other than getting the folks back together and everything, but were there any kind of technical challenges that you faced or any kind of, interesting kind of, asides that you can share with us as far as what that presented?
The only real challenge I had was just trying to make everything work on the limited time schedule that we had, because we had a very short shooting schedule. And, you know, if you want to do a movie right, as Reggie can tell you, you want to go for more than, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. You want to kind of, you know, spread it out at least, you know, 5 or 6 weeks or more. But I was forced to sort of think real quick on my feet and make the scenes as good as I could. I had envisioned a couple of the scenes to be a little bit, a little broader, a little bigger. But the only real problem we had was when we were shooting at the drive-in the very first time, and we had a nice, beautiful, sunny day, and we shot, and then we were going to come back on the second day, and this was in Barstow, California, miles and miles and miles from where we're at, you know, like 2-hour drive or whatever. And the second day, the rain started coming in that night, and it started to snow, and I couldn't believe it. I had everybody up there in a hotel, and it was snowing, and it was a disaster. And that was how we left the first part of the filming. I had to leave on that sour note. So that was just devastating to me, you know, that we couldn't finish that and it started to snow and it was the worst luck ever. And so when I got the money 6 years later, we went back to the scene of the crime and we finished those scenes at the drive-in. And I'm telling you, there's a couple of cuts in that drive-in sequence, you know, during these Lips That Never Lie, where they're singing in 2004 or sitting in a car, and then they get out in 2010, and we cut. You would never know it. The actors didn't change. You would never. I challenge you to tell me where those scenes are. You know, the time differences. It's amazing. So that was really the only challenge, I think. That and making sure Reggie was there to perform at 100%. No, that was no challenge. Are you kidding? Well, you know, the thing of it is, a lot of people have told me they really like you in this movie, Reggie. You know, they think that you give a real great performance in this film. And I really wanted, you know, Reggie being a friend and having worked with him before, I wanted to give Reggie a role that would be a little different for him, something that he can really do that really showed off his acting chops, you know. And I personally feel that I accomplished that. You know, I think that the role that you do in the film is very, very good.
I love the character. King is just a really trippy guy, and then his relationship with Lily is terrific. He's really bigger than life.
Well, you know, my favorite scene in the movie is the scene between you and Creed Bratton when you're sitting in the dark, a very simple, kind of a long scene, but
yeah.
I left it long because I like it so much, and that really is a simple scene, but it is my favorite scene in the movie. I just think it really works, and the acting is good, and it's interesting, and just watching these two guys go back and forth, I found it to be very, very entertaining.
Yeah, it was really great working with Creed in that scene, and I think that Heather Provost, who played Lily, with just a few lines, really stole that scene.
Oh, yeah. She was
chewing her nails.
Absolutely.
You know that, Mike?
Biggest, greatest. Yeah.
Biggest, greatest. Yeah.
Do you guys have any personal favorite scenes in the movie?
I thought, in terms of production and the acting and everything, it's a great piece. I thought it was a phenomenal film, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you can do with it. So, you know, I know this is just sort of starting to roll out with various festivals and things like that, but what's been the reaction when you've started to show it now that it's locked and it's finished?
Well, I think the reaction has been very positive. The only thing, if there's a negative, I think some folks, you know, you just never know, because people going in expecting it to be Rocky Horror Picture Show may be somewhat disappointed because it doesn't have that the grunginess or the naughtiness or I don't know what I'm trying to say, but the Johnny X is a little more innocent, you know, and I wanted to make it kind of an innocent film, something that could be considered maybe in the future a classic, something that, you know, everyone can watch. But it's still, I didn't aim it for kids or anything. It still has that sort of sexiness going on. But, you know, and some folks may think that the songs are too theater type, you know, show tunes, as opposed to what they are hoping for, rockabilly. But that's a very small, very, very small clique. But most of the folks that I've seen watch the film were laughing and, you know, when we have a big audience and very positive. I mean, Reggie, wouldn't you say that...
Yeah, everybody, when we were up at Cinequest and saw it with, you know, that room full of strangers in the dark, it was a lot of fun. They had a lot of fun. And you know, if I may say, I think the only comparison that you could draw between the ghastly love of Johnny X and Rocky Horror Picture Show is that I think The Ghastly Love of Johnny X could be run at midnight screenings forever and ever, amen, because I think it's just that classic, and people are going to, like, take it personally to themselves and to their own taste, and I think they're, you know, I think it's just it's a classic. It's just going to go on and on.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, Reggie. I'll see you at midnight then.
I'll see you there. Your house or mine?
Yeah, well, at the theater, of course.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so you know, it's interesting because a girl came up to me after one of the screenings and she just profusely thanked me for making the movie. She said, "Thank you for making this movie for me," you know. And I felt so good about that. I'll be honest, it's really hard for me to watch my films with people. I get distracted and I see what people are reacting or if they're not reacting, and it's very, very difficult. And I almost at this point would rather not go to any more film festivals and have to sit there with an audience watching the film. I just keep my fingers crossed that they liked it, you know, and hear good things. But you know, I've sat through a lot of these screenings and I kind of know now what the general consensus is of people and what they're thinking and, you know, and I think for the most part, they are very entertained and it's not what they originally expected it to be. But it turns out to be something in some ways maybe better, you know, but you know, something different than what they had thought. And, you know, maybe I got a couple of comments where in almost everyone says this, well, maybe it's a little too long here or there. It could be trimmed down. But they say I was never bored. So, you know, that's a good thing. So I think the movie works for what it is. And I'm hoping it will be kind of a future classic and will catch on in years from now and sort of be looked back upon as this, you know, kind of special little movie that was made in the indie film circuit back in the 2010s, you know, 20-teens. But it was a lot of fun, and I had fun making the movie, and I'm glad you guys enjoyed it, and I was so thrilled to be able to work with Reggie again, and I think we'll work again, Reggie, right?
Oh, I think absolutely.
We'll work on the next picture I'm going to do.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've been practicing my laugh.
Oh, the man who laughs,
yes.
Yes. Well, we'll talk about that someday.
Yeah.
So we'll talk to you in 2018, is that right?
No. This one will be getting going much quicker than that. I'm going to get the next one. It's based on a Victor Hugo novel called The Man Who Laughs, and we're working on the script right now, and we hope to get into production, you know, as soon as we can, really. And it's going to be a really cool movie. It's going to be totally different than Johnny X. There's no singing, no dancing, no juvenile delinquents from outer space, but there is a boy with a hideously shaped face who is his face. Well, you know, I don't even want to discuss it.
No, don't talk about it.
It's just going to be marvelous, and it's my own take on it. We're doing our own version of based on Victor Hugo's novel. We're not going to do it, you know, verbatim. I hope to shoot that one on 35mm as well and project it digitally, so it'll be great. Great-looking movie.
Welcome back. Here's a bonus interview we did with Johnny X himself, Will Keenan.
What's up with Johnny?
Why are we hanging around?
This place is cute, but it's time to scoot because the resurrection suit was found.
So how did you get involved with the whole Johnny X thing?
You know, it's a funny story, and I don't know what Paul says these days, but years and years ago, I think it was like my first or second year in L.A., a mutual acquaintance of ours, indie filmmaker named Ramzi Abed, was friends with Paul, and I had met him somewhere, I think via kind of the trauma connections. And then he set up this meeting with Paul and I. Remember, it was out in Burbank at the Bob's Big Boy. And Paul was telling me his vision about this movie. And he asked me to play the lead, and I said, sure. And then I think it was just a couple months later, maybe, that we shot for about a week. And he got about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes worth of footage. And I think at the time he was hoping to, and again, I don't know what he says about all this, but I think at the time he was hoping to cut something together and then raise the rest of the funds for the movie. None of us knew this at the time. We were just like, oh, we're shooting for a week, and then we'll shoot, you know, a couple weeks later or something. But then, you know, I think because it's a kind of a highly stylized kind of throwback to the 50s kind of piece, you know, in black and white, a musical, very niche oriented, he was having trouble getting the rest of the funding. And then every year he would call us, me and the rest of the cast, be like, I think I got the money this time. And every, you know, years and years would, you know, years went by. I think it was like 6 or 7 years. So after the second year, I stopped kind of just believing it, you know, just figured the movie would never get made. And then I was producing a movie called Politics of Love. And then I starred in Trent's movie right after. And I got the call from Paul saying, I got the money. And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then I started getting calls from the production manager, and the wardrobe people came over to fit me. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, this might actually be happening. And then at the time I said, hey, you know, I was really, really busy with the films I was producing. And I said, look, you only got 15, you know, 20 minutes in the can. Why don't you recast? I actually tried to talk him into recasting, but he wouldn't do it. And I got to give him credit, you know, not only for being able to kind of stick with the movie for that long, but, you know, to be able to get everyone back together after that many years and, you know, finally to pull it off. And, you know, it's a great little movie. I really, really enjoy the movie itself. And I hope it continues to play fast and kind of hits that audience. I think there is an audience for that movie. And I just hope it finds it, you know, but so far so good.
When you were working on it, what were you trying to bring across with the character? What were you trying to develop with it?
I liked the idea that it was going to be done in a style I had never done before. You know, black and white and you know, like kind of Paul's vision with, like I said, kind of a throwback to the 50s. And it was the first character I'd been asked to play that wasn't like crazy. You know, it was my kind of strong, silent character that I had never gotten to play before. So I was really excited about that. But, you know, after shooting the first week, you know, 7 years ago or 8 years ago, whenever it was, you know, through the years when he would call us, he would also send us, you know, call us saying, hey, I think I got the money. He would also send us new scripts. And the scripts changed so much that by the time, and I guess maybe I shouldn't be saying this on a podcast, but by the time Johnny X, you know, the shoot was scheduled to finish the movie, I'd just gotten off of Chop. And before that, I had just gotten off of A Politics of Love. And Politics of Love was an indie film I produced, and I was also in it, and it was a really tough job. And then I went right to Chop, where, you know, there was a lot of lines in Chop, and I would have to memorize my lines the night before the shoot. And then right after that was Johnny X. And let's just say I didn't get to, you know, I'm kind of a Virgo perfectionist. I didn't get to spend as much time on the character as I had wanted to. And in certain cases, I was actually learning the lines on the set or the morning of. So when I look at, like I said, I think it's a great little movie. I think a number of actors really knock it out of the park. I'm not, you know, entirely happy with my own performance because I know I can do better. But, you know, it was also the kind of character where there wasn't that many lines, and it wasn't a broad character where I had to kind of, you know, kind of create a role and a characterization. So I kind of just, you know, phoned it in, so to speak.
You did have a really great cast working with you on this film. Were there any good, you know, kind of behind the scenes stories of working with, you know, Bannister or some of these guys.
Yeah, I mean, they were all, I mean, not only was it, is it a great looking movie, but everyone involved was such, was so cool. Like all the people, like Jed and Deanna and Reggie and, you know, all the girls in the girl gang, my guys, everyone was really cool and really felt like we were a part of something special. And there are some, you know, we did get goofy behind the scenes quite a bit, but nothing I can probably tell out of school. And then I became known as the only real diva on set. I don't know. I guess I stayed in character a little too much in between shots.
Fair enough. Hey, you said that you play kind of the strong silent type in this film. I'm trying to remember, how was it kind of playing a musical? Because is this the first musical that you've done?
Yes. It was the first time I sang on camera. And, you know, besides Paul being, and Paul's definitely one of the most kind of creative and fun directors I've ever worked with. It was really cool to watch him work on set. And he always, you know, the vibe on set was always really, really good. But when he had first contacted me about it, when we had talked about it at that Bob's Big Boy, I thought, you know, I was the lead in what gets credit for being the first digital feature film, Love God, back in 1996. And I'm convinced that Johnny X will be the last widescreen black and white musical ever. You know, so I was like, damn, I definitely want to do this. Not only is it a character I've never gotten to play, like a kind of strong silent type, but it's the kind of movie that may never be made again. And to boot, I get to sing. And I don't consider myself a singer, really, although I can carry a tune. But, you know, I thought, you know, I like to try new things, obviously. And I thought it'd be cool to, for posterity's sake, to have sung in a movie and be on a soundtrack singing. And I think I did all right at that.
I think you talked about it a little bit, but what has sort of been your take on the reactions? I mean, you've gone to some of the festivals and people have come up to you afterwards. What have you heard and how have you felt about how people have reacted to it?
It's been really good. I have to admit, like, because the script went through so many changes through the years, by the time I showed up on set, and like I said, I had just gotten off this other movie and there was really no break in between, so I was having to kind of, you know, learn my lines as we went along. I probably gave a cursory review of the script, but I didn't know it inside and out like I normally do. So when I finally saw the finished product, we had a couple of screenings out here in LA, Paul had for the cast and crew. I was blown away. I had no idea, you know, what to expect. And then when I did see it, I was like, holy shit, what the hell is this? And I've done some weird movies, you know. So it's got this lovable weirdness to it. And then this, you know, there's a lot of really, you know, interesting and, you know, fun characters. But the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, my God, what the hell is this? And then, because, you know, sometimes I second guess my own judgment. And then I saw it, you know, with kind of an untainted audience at San Jose with a bunch of people where that accident happened. And they loved it. The reaction was really, really good. And even after the Q&A, I was sitting down in the front row. A lot of people came up to me and, you know, obviously, you know, sometimes when you meet actors at festivals, you just kind of blow smoke up their asses and tell them good things. But I grill people, you know, when they say something like, you know, if they say they really liked it, oh, what'd you like about it? And then they'll, you know, come up with a bunch of different things. And, you know, so it's really seemed genuine. And I think there's, like I said, I think there's definitely an audience for the movie. And then there's a bunch of people who, you know, as far as nostalgia is concerned, are really into that kind of thing. So those people love, love, love the movie. It's like, you know, not everyone loves Tyler Perry movies, but there's an audience there that absolutely, you know, adores them. So I think there's an audience for Johnny X that will absolutely adore it, you know, as long as it gets out there. And I'm pretty sure it will. I think it's going to play the festival circuit for a while. You know, hopefully it'll get some kind of limited theatrical or theatrical, and, you know, maybe there's a TV play there, but it'll definitely, I think, you know, be on video and VOD and probably Netflix and some of the other online streaming sites.
I have to ask, did you get to keep the jacket when everything was over?
No. And that,
no.
Not at all. And, you know, my costume, my wardrobe in that film was, I'm told, an exact replica of what Brando wore in The Wild One. And it was a, you know, very cool outfit. And, you know, Paul's wife it was the costume designer. And she works a whole lot in Hollywood as a wardrobe designer. So they put, you know, all the girls and guys, gangs, you know, wardrobe together. And, you know, she was very on top of it. One of the most professional people I've ever worked with. And, you know, yes, I tried to walk away with it and they wouldn't let me. And in fact, a year later, I asked to borrow it for a shoot and they wouldn't even let me borrow it.
Wow.
Yeah. They either spent a whole lot of money and want to keep it, or they're creating a museum in their house and they're putting it in there.
Is there anything else on Johnny X that stands out that maybe we didn't get a chance to ask you about?
You know, it's a real testament to independent film that this guy was able to pull this off in the way he was able to pull it off. So it gives me, you know, it gives me hope for indie film, which has kind of been decimated the past few years. You know, so many changes. It was never really a sustainable business, but it's gotten, you know, harder than ever to finance and to you know, actually make a film. It's like a miracle if you actually get something in the can.
I think I'm one of the few people that has had the honor of seeing Love God, and I was very curious about what happened to that film, why it kind of just disappeared after it came out.
Well, you saw it, you said. What'd you think of it?
I liked it. I liked it a lot.
I did too. You know, I'm not sure other than, you know, the story of that film is that Sony, I think it was Sony, had developed this digital Betacam, you know, the first ones to do it. And they gave it to, you know, Good Machine, one of the most reputable independent film companies out of New York, to test the camera. They just wanted Good Machine to do a test with it. And Good Machine, led by Anthony Bregman, who was started out as one of the founders of Good Machine, Ted Hope's assistant. This was Anthony's first, you know, feature producing gig. So Anthony pitched, I think, to Ted saying, hey, rather than just do a test with this digital beta camera, why don't we make a whole movie with it? Why don't we make this movie? And it was the Love God script, you know, by Frank Groh, which was a crazy little script. And, you know, so they went for it. And, you know, the movie was made and, you know, again, it was a really great group of people. We were kind of pioneers in the sense that, you know, this was the first fully digital feature film. And it was really out there. You know, I think there was over 2,000 music cues in the movie or something like that. Like crazy amount of post-production. And, you know, it opened at Sundance and midnight and people were pretty blown away by it. But this was, I think, 1999 Sundance. And Sundance was already pretty big, but it was really, you know, I think it was kind of going through its next phase, you know, of the Sundance that we know today. And, you know, I guess it just wasn't the kind of movie at the time. I think it was probably a little bit before its time, you know. And Good Machine is such a, was, you know, and they've now since, you know, James Shamus and Ted Hope, the founders of Good Machine, eventually you know, dissolved it. James went on to Focus Features and Ted went on to This Is That. You know, I think Good Machine at the time, they were making so many movies that, you know, when it didn't sell like their other movies do at Sundance, you know, and there weren't at the time, besides like Troma, there were a few other, you know, kind of cult film distributors, you know, but distribution was a different thing back then. So, you know, I'm not really sure what happened other than it just didn't have the legs we all, I think, thought it could have had or hoped it would have.
Yeah, you've actually been in quite a few films that I've seen that I'm just always, you know, blown away by. I love The Love Machine as well. I had the pleasure of seeing that one in Chicago years and years ago, and I thought that one was great too.
Thank you. Yeah, that's Gordon Erickson's movie. That was a lot of fun. One of the same financiers, Steve Menken of Love God, who's become a good friend. And another interesting film, you know, kind of ahead of its time. Yeah, but that was fun. And that was, you know, improv-based, which is something else I'd, you know, kind of been trained in. So that was, I think, my first improvisation-based film. Like, you know, he'd given us a structure and told us what the, you know, essentially what the crux of the scenes were. But as far as the dialogue, we just, you know, rehearsed it a few times, you know, improvising. And then they started, you know, rolling cameras. So I had fun on that one.
Yeah, that one was definitely ahead of its time, because that whole you don't know if it's real or not throughout the whole thing until really the end credits.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was a few
really
of them
like that.
Even OMC was like that a little bit, where we're kind of messing with people out in the real world, and you're kind of, you know, doing it for a scene, a narrative scene in your movie. So people are like, oh my God, was that real? That wasn't real? And now it's kind of all the rage. You see it all over YouTube, you know, just messing with people in real life and Borat and so forth. You know, so we were doing that years and years ago, but it was almost too new. People didn't know what to think of it. You know, all we had really was like candid camera.
Yeah, I know some people that I saw it with were kind of mad. They're just like, they were tricked. So it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
They felt that way. How did you get involved with RA 1?
Years ago, I guess around 2006, 2007, I was living in Hollywood and working, you know, producing a few indie films. And once the economy crashed, indie film was left for dead, pretty much. You know, I used to get, you know, I used to raise financing for independent films, you know, from a few Wall Street guys, you know, who, you know, knew the chances of them making their money back were pretty slim, you know, but it was about being a part of, you know, a cool project and, you know, meeting actresses at parties. But, you know, when the economy took the downturn here, it was really rough for a while. So the Wall Street guys were gone. The hedge funds were gone. This was the time where even if you had an A-list actor, it was still hard to, you know, get foreign pre-sales from the usual suspects, unless it was a studio movie, you know, a sequel at that, you know. So it was really, really rough. And I had this one project where about 70% of the story was set in India. So in my mind, I started, you know, reading up on the economy and, you know, especially, you know, film finance. And rather than just kind of admit defeat, I said, okay, to me, you know, for me to continue, the new independent is international. And the new foreign presale is working with stars in other star-based film industries, right? So, and it's, you know, still the case today. Russia has a burgeoning film industry. India has a larger film industry than the United States. They release more movies theatrically than the United States does. You know, Korea, there's all these, you know, even before the Arab Spring, and I'm sure it'll come back, but Egypt had a little burgeoning film industry there. So I started to look around, and if you had, you know, attached stars from Korea or Russia or India, then that was a way to find, you know, to kind of, you know, get the budget for your film, to finance your film. So after I did all this research, I just kind of took an exploratory trip out to India. And I'm told by, you know, my friends, my Indian friends that I have now, that it was because I was, you know, American and I had some legitimate credits behind me that I was able to, you know, kind of network quite a bit when I got out there and started, you know, talking with and working with some pretty established producers, directors, and stars in India. So it was after a movie, one of the movies I had co-produced called Hiss, that we made in India, that I then met with Shah Rukh Khan, the star and producer of RA 1. And I helped out a bit on RA 1 in the development stage, where I brought some of the writers and some of the effects people. And then I would really have liked to have stayed on that production. But I was, at that point, had committed to producing Politics of Love. So I had to do that instead. So like two essentially financed, produced movies that were financed out, two movies that were financed out of India, and was involved with the development on some other Indian films. And then I produced some music and some music videos for the films in India. And it was an incredible, incredible time. I think there was 3.5-4 years where I was going to India a lot and working there, and, you know, staying for months at a time and shooting there and traveling all over India for the promotions of the movies. It was incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very cool. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, and this was probably top when I last actually saw you in the flesh, probably 10 years ago, was everyone knows your love of Buster Keaton. And at the time you were trying to get this Buster Keaton biopic going. Any chance of that ever happening for you?
I doubt it. You know, that was something that when I'd always been, my mother says I've been doing stunts since I was a baby, right? She said I learned to run before I learned to walk, and she would always find me on the roof at 2 years of age. And so I was always a stuntman. It was just kind of in my blood, you know? And then when I started, when I was at NYU and I was doing a lot of theater, it was a lot of movement theater, and I would just kind of integrate stunts into whatever I was doing. And then I started doing it in film. I think, you know, trauma, you know, safety first on a trauma set. I don't think I got to do anything, you know, physical or any stunts on trauma. And then Love God, I think, was my first real stunt on the film. I asked if I could, you know, my character was schizophrenic, and he was in the middle of an episode, and he had this this disorder, God, I forget the name of it, where when he's in the middle of an episode, he has to read everything he sees and then try to destroy it, you know. So I talked Anthony Bregman, the producer, and Frank Rowe, the director, into letting me climb up a New York City lamppost and trying to rip down the sign. And they were crazy enough to let me do it, although some of the other production managers and producers had to leave set because they didn't like it. After those two films, when I made my first short film, Hoof Boy, I put a bunch of stunts in that. But it was Anthony Bregman during Love Gods who said to me, "Wow, you're just like Buster Keaton." And I said, "Who?" Because I didn't know who Buster Keaton was at the time. And it was after that film, you know, Love God especially, and then Hoof Boy, that people kept saying, "Wow, you're like the, you know, the Buster Keaton of the new century." And so I started looking at Buster's work, and I was like, "Oh, interesting," you know. And I realized that we did have a lot in common physically. And then a few people had come to me and said, you know, what do you think about making a biopic of Buster Keaton? I said, sure, I'm game, but it's going to be tough, you know, because I wasn't an A-list star or anything, and it's hard to get films financed in that way. So there had been a few scripts throughout the years and a couple different people really wanting to get behind it. But I kind of, you know, I kind of let it go a few years ago. So I don't expect it's going to come back.
Do you feel that maybe you've aged out, that you can't, you're not as elastic as you used to be?
Well, you know, Buster broke a lot of bones. Jackie Chan, God knows how many bones. I'll tell you this, it's just, I think it's in my blood. If a Buster Keaton movie were to get financed with me as the lead right now, I'd need about 3 weeks to get into shape, but I know I could pull it off.
Beyond that, what's sort of the latest in the wild, wide world of Will Keenan for all those who want to know?
Right now, I was recruited as an executive at one of the largest networks on YouTube. It's a huge web video company, and it was started by a number of YouTube stars. It's called Maker Studios. And I've had my eye on YouTube and web video as a medium in general for the past 4 years. And really, really interested in it because, you know, I've literally nearly killed myself for independent film. And, you know, it's, you know, as Ted Hope, someone else who I kind of consider a mentor and have worked with from Good Machine, I mean, he's been sounding the alarm for a few years now that indie film is going to go the way of ballet and opera if indie filmmakers don't kind of get with it and stop making self-indulgent projects that no one wants to see. And then I guess it was about last year, I really felt in that the best creativity is now happening online, you know, and you can have an indie, you know, an independent film that opens up at Sundance or another huge festival, and it can run for 8 months on the festival circuit, but you're still lucky if you get a theatrical, limited theatrical. You're lucky if you get a TV deal. You know, I can get you a VOD and DVD deal, but at the end of the day, you're lucky if 5,000 people see your independent film. And I'm looking online, and I'm working with a lot of the top YouTube stars now. These kids are getting millions and millions of eyeballs on their stuff, you know? And, you know, I was always someone who wanted, you know, the projects I worked on to reach, you know, the largest audience possible. And I just think, you know, unless it's a studio movie that has 50 to 100 million, you know, marketing dollars behind it, you know, stuff is getting seen now. Careers are being made now. The new kind of discovery at Schwab's drugstore is YouTube, is online. I got back from India May of last year, my last trip there. And then I really actually made a concerted effort. I said to myself, I really want to crack this web video nut. You know, I really want to get into this stuff. I've been watching it for years. And then I'm kind of one of those guys who believes that, you know, whatever you think about, you bring about. And then I, you know, this opportunity came to me to work with Maker Studios. And I've been working with them ever since on web video working with online talent and producing and creating kind of networks on YouTube. And it's been quite an education. I'm getting out of it everything I kind of wanted to. I've now consider myself, or at least in, you know, my indie film contemporaries, you know, consider me an expert in online video and YouTube now. And I think, you know, it's becoming a sustainable business. There's lots of ad dollars moving online. And, you know, a lot of these top YouTube stars are making over $1 million a year. You know, not that it's all about money, but if what you want to do is keep creating, you know, I think these days online is the way to go.
Do you think that that is sort of what could possibly replace the old models of indie film, obviously, when you first got into it over, say, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's global distribution, you know, essentially. And if you get the views, you get the money. If I were just starting out today, I'd be going right to YouTube. Absolutely. Nowadays in colleges, there are kind of web video classes and there are, you know, you can learn about this stuff, you know, at school, but you could also learn about it just by doing it online, you know. But if you build up an audience online, that can translate, you know, if what you want to do is kind of, you know, go to TV or film, you know. Like there's a couple of, you know, people I work with at Maker who have huge audiences online just from YouTube, and they want to get into features, right? One of them, took some of the money he made online. He made a low-budget film, which looks great, for $200,000 in the can. And he's got, and he was smart. He cast a bunch of YouTube stars in the movie. So now he's got, you know, collectively across the cast, 9 million subscribers, you know, he can market this movie to. And these kids online who are fans of these YouTube stars and fans of this YouTube filmmaker are begging for the movie, you know? So even, you know, and you know, we'll take it to the usual suspects, the film festivals and the distributors. But plan B is that he makes his movie available for $5 a pop on VOD. You know, chances are, because they have so many subscribers online, that he's going to make, you know, not only his money back, but make a profit. And guess what? He gets to make another movie, you know? And the other thing I would, you know, kind of going back to the international aspect, you know, I see so many, and I still, you know, I still have lots of, you know, young filmmakers and friends coming to me to, you know, to ask me to either act in their movies or to help finance or to help produce or package with cast their movies. And, you know, one of the things I say all the time is that, you know, stop thinking just about America. It's so hard to have a successful independent film in America. You know, what is it, like one a year that actually makes its money back? You know, I think 188 out of 300 independent movies that were released last year made like, you know, $10,000 at the box office. So I'll often tell them, hey, look, instead of casting a bunch of random white people in your movie, because let's face it, most indie filmmakers, their films are auditions to be a studio filmmaker, right? So they'll cast a kid who's good looking, who looks like Brad Pitt. But your film is going up against Brad Pitt. It's not going to work. You know, the market, the American, you know, market for films is inundated. Everyone's making movies, right? They're making iPhone movies. So instead of casting random white people, cast a bunch of Indians. There's 4 million Indians in the United States who would love it. You know, there's all these underserved audiences, you know, the African, the urban audience, you know, the gay audience, you know, turn your horror script into a gay horror script, you know, try to serve an audience so that it's a success with a niche. And then you could take that to the studio and be like, okay, you know, this movie made money. It made its money back. You know, anyone who makes a movie where it makes its money back, chances are at least 50% they're going to get to make another movie. So that to me is what it's about. Like, you know, being smart about, you know, and it took me a while to learn this, and I still have a lot to learn, the kind of the business behind it. All my early films were just me trying to show off or me trying to, you know, make some stuff where people would say, wow, you're so talented, you know, and I got to travel the festival circuit and be treated like a rock star for years. but that, you know, ultimately didn't serve me, at least as far as my larger goals.
Lots of advice and sort of the changing landscape of indie film. A lot of things that I think a lot of people who I know around here in the Detroit area that make movies probably don't even realize at this point. Because I think, as you're right, most people who do either make short films or low-budget features are basically sort of looking at it as a reel to get themselves onto the studio lot and make a big film.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think we all, I mean, globalization is one thing, but I think we can all think globally now. I mean, you know, going back to YouTube, 70% of all the views from YouTube come outside the United States, right? So if you're making a movie, and I've talked to young filmmakers, and oftentimes, like, even if they have a good project, I'll really grill them, you know, to see kind of where their heart's at behind it all. And too many times, you know, and I keep asking them questions to kind of get to the bottom of it all, you know, will they say something like, I just want to be able to control people's emotions, you know, having them sit in a theater and being able to control their emotions. Now, you know, I'm not going to judge the situation, but to me, that's not what it's about. You know, I think especially indie filmmakers have to start giving people what they want. You know, yes, you can put your style on it and you can make it cool, but, you know, and you can talk about, you know, certain things that, you know, aren't in studio movies. But at the end of the day, people have to want to see your film. You're not making it for yourself. You're making it for other people. Even Ted Hope said, you know, just the past few years, indie film as a Google search term has gone way, way down. Kids don't watch indie films. I mean, there's definitely some horror fanatics out there and some, you know, some of the other niches. But you're not going to, you know, kids are watching YouTube. And you have to start giving people what they want. People don't want to see self-indulgent independent films that they can't understand.
That was Will Keenan. And of course, we'll hear more from Will in a few weeks when we cover his first starring role in Troma's classic, Tromeo and Juliet. Now, Mike, I know this is something that we alluded to during the interview with Paul and Reggie, but I wanted to know how you felt about that sort of timeless aesthetic that's going on in Johnny X.
I think that it works. It took me a little by surprise when there were things that seemed kind of anachronistic. It kind of reminded me of Edward Scissorhands, where you're watching it and everything seems to be in a 1950s setting. And then Anthony Michael Hall is like, you know, my dad's VCR and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, whoa, VCR or an answering machine and stuff. It's like, this stuff didn't exist in the 50s. And it's like, well, maybe had you kind of introduced that a little bit earlier, then it would have made a little bit less jarring, as it were. But yeah, with Johnny X, I think for the most part it works, though I keep insisting in my mind as I'm watching it that it is Earth of the 1950s rather than Earth whatever of the 2000 and whatevers, just because there were some things that just kind of struck me as being out of time. I don't know about you. How does it work for you?
You know, actually, I don't think it's that anachronistic. I remember, like, you were talking about things where, okay, it's supposed to be set in the 50s, or at least that's the idea, and then they'll have things like, you know, someone sucking on a big gulp or something. But it's, I think they were very faithful to the time period. I mean, with the cars and with the hair and the dress and everything like that, there's really not too many things that kind of stick out for me that doesn't seem to fit within that aesthetic. I mean, they even went so far as to, with the TV show where they show it on the TV, it's shown on a screen that's like a 1950s television. The ads that they put in for the TV show are 1950s ads. The Coke bottles are 1950s Coke bottles. The diner, you know, scene is very 1950s. So as much as it seems to play in this alternate universe of 1950 California desert kind of thing, I think it's very faithful. You can really see that they put an eye to the design and really tried to keep a lot of iconic ideas within it. So to me, it doesn't seem so sort of fish out of water. There's not too many things in there that have a tendency to pull me out and go, oh, this isn't of that time.
But there are just a few things here and there where it's just like, whoa, you know, but that's just mostly me being I don't know, being kind of sucked into the world. And then every once in a while, it's like, you know, but this world is bigger than just this time period. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
You know, a lot of this, I think, was shot around like Monument Valley. So there's a lot of stuff in there that if you've seen 50s sci-fi or you've seen like Westerns and stuff like that, that you're like, oh, okay, I totally know this landscape, because it's kind of burned into your head that this is sort of the go-to place when we need to go to the desert in sci-fi movies of the 50s or Westerns, cheapy Westerns.
Just that cave entrance reminded me of a lot of It Came from Outer Space or The Thing That Conquered the World. The one with Leslie Nielsen and Lee Van Cleef that they used to do on MST3K all the time. You know, he learned too late that man was a feeling creature, and it had that great kind of pointy alien that came out of that cave. So, but that's just me. And Robot Monster, you know, also very famous for its cave and everything.
So, you know, not only does it sort of echo these 1950s movies, I would put Johnny X sort of in the same vein as there seems to have been, I'd say maybe over the last 10, 15 years, where people have gone in and they've taken a lot of these cheap sci-fi aesthetics and tried to sort of remake in some way sort of the ideas or the sort of the tropes of those films and put them in a modern context. And one of which that came out, I think it was in 2000, was Lost Skeleton of Cadavera. And I remembered that one specifically because people were talking about it and were like, oh, this is like, you know, someone making an Ed Wood movie today or something. And I think that Johnny X is in that vein, but I would actually say it's probably on a higher level.
I know Lost Skeleton is very polarizing, which is so bizarre that a movie like that would either, you know, you love it or you hate it so much of the time, because there are people that just kind of rejected that faux cheapness and everything. For me, I enjoyed it. I don't go back and watch it, and I've never seen the sequel to it or anything. The one that really got under my skin and really just kind of drove me crazy was this one called Alien Trespass with the guy from Will and Grace in it. That one just seemed like they were trying way too hard to do that kind of 50s thing and just not understanding the fun of it, or, you know, they weren't, it looked like they weren't having fun with that movie, and it wasn't fun to watch. It was a real slog to watch. But then you compare that to something like John Pace's Invasion, or AKA Top of the Food Chain, where it does kind of have this 50s feel to it, but there's just so many bizarro little turns and jokes and all this kind of stuff that you can, the people in the film are, you know, very deadpan, especially the professor character is very, very straight-laced and everything. But what he says is so ridiculous that it's just so fun to watch and so funny. I guess it's either way, you know. And then there's a film, I don't know if you've ever seen J. Wade Edwards' Shout, Stomp, Scream. I always have to pause before I say that. That one has that kind of 50s aesthetic, plays it straight, but also is having fun at the same time. It's not making fun of the 1950s aesthetic. It's just kind of using that as a springboard to tell a story. If you're a fan of the 1950s films and you're not making fun of the films, if you have a real respect for them, I mean, and I kind of go back and forth. It just depends on what the movie is. Shout, Stomp, Scream, it kind of does that with the best as far as these films.
I think that you really hit the nail on the head, though, is that people who enjoy those, say you enjoy the Ed Wood films or you enjoy the some of the early Roger Corman stuff, there is an earnestness to it. They're not trying to do something camp and kitsch. They're just trying to make a film. And in their trying to make the film, it becomes camp and kitsch. So I can understand where that division is with something like Lost Skeleton, where when I saw it, I liked it, but I wasn't like bowled over by it. I know some people are like, oh, this is amazing. I'm like, not really, because they know what keys to hit now. They know what keys to hit in order to make the that idea happen, where back in the 50s, they were just trying to make the movie, and that's just how it happened to come out.
So, you know, one of the films that kind of gets lumped in with these, and one of the films that always drives me crazy when people say, oh, this movie, it's so bad that it's good, and, you know, people kind of latched onto it and da 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 da, was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. To me, that wasn't a poorly made film. It definitely was kind of a throwback to the 1950s, but it was that kind of, I don't know what it was about the 1950s being this kind of trope in the 1970s, you know, and then again in the 2000s. But we should probably talk a little bit about how these kind of cheapy sci-fi films, they kind of, you know, they played well with the whole musical genre, you know, and it really fits well with Johnny X. It fits well with Rocky Horror. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's kind of built into our maybe our cultural intelligence, because when we think about the 50s, I would say now, at least in terms of where most people come from pop culture, when it comes to the 50s, I'd say probably their first latch in might even be music. You're looking at things like Elvis. And then I would say, even for people my generation who are in their early 30s, it's Grease. So for us, the 50s has always been about like guys in leathers with slick back hair singing songs. So I don't understand. I mean, to me, it works. So it's like it's kind of already built in some way into, I would say, our cultural intelligence on the 50s, at least in the pop culture realm. So I don't think it's that much of a stretch. I think it gets harder when you try to move it to other eras for some reason, because we don't really have a musical that maybe defines that particular era.
Right. I guess the only thing I would throw in there is kind of Reefer Madness, the musical, which it is set, I believe, in the 30s or 40s, but it sure has a 50s feel. It definitely has that mom and apple pie, you know, Eisenhower era kind of thing going on to it. And that's another one that is, to me, absolutely terrific. You know, a musical that they tried to make, oh God, I want to say recently, but it was probably 10 years ago, that just doesn't work for me. And it's one of these films, these kind of being lumped in with this, you know, cult film grouping. And I've tried to watch it now 3 times, and I just can never make it past the first, I'd say, 15, 20 minutes, is Repo, the Genetic Opera. I just have such a hard time with the songs. The songs are so poorly written to me. It's like the music isn't really catchy at all, and the lyrics just feel like they're kind of words being sung over something else, and they don't even kind of match to the music for me. I don't know if you ever even got suckered into that film, but for me, it just doesn't go at all.
I had heard of it, but I hadn't seen it. But then again, you know, I think what really, to be honest, it's like I'm not a big musical guy. And I think part of the reason why I haven't been a big musical guy was because, and this is going to be sad, and I'm going to tell you about a trauma in my childhood, so don't laugh at me, was when I was 9 years old, I was forced into a after-school daycare program that made me sit in a chair for 3 straight days and watch The Sound of Music over and over again. And ever since then, whenever The Sound of Music is referenced to me, I kind of have like a Vietnam flashback kind of thing. So it's a trauma that I'm working through. I've got therapists on this. But the thing is since then, I've had trouble watching musicals. And I'm just now in my advanced years, now that I'm far beyond 9 years old, working on being able to watch musicals again and really appreciate them, because there's nothing better for destroying the ability to enjoy anything than having someone force you to sit there and watch it for 3 days over and over and over again.
I can totally see you with like the little Alex, you know, eye openers and stuff. And you're like, please, sir, no, not this again.
It's a crime. It's a crime the way you're using Julie Andrews like that. Please make it stop. I can't even enjoy Mary Poppins now, you bastards.
Well, stick with me, Rob. I know some good musicals that will hopefully help you get past this block in your life. So, I mean, starting with some of the stuff that we've talked about on the show before, you know, I know you've had to have seen the Forbidden Zone, American Astronaut, some of these. They'll help you. I don't know if anything will ever cure you of that, but they'll help you get past that block.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're more than welcome. All right, we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
That's my purse! Stop him! Stop! Somebody, please help me!
Go get him!
Thank you, officer.
Yeah, that's great, lady.
But you're a cop!
He's got my old badge, Sanchez. He's running around playing cop, assaulting and beating people. Police! Drop the gun, son!
An anonymous, apparently off-duty police officer interrupted a robbery tonight, heroically confronting an armed robber with only bottles of spaghetti sauce.
I used to rob people who robbed people.
Kind of like Robin Hood?
Yeah, except I didn't give the money to the poor people.
Well, the bellman also said the guy had a hooker with him.
Buy a nice little house with a white picket fence. You live happily ever after.
I tell you what, let's go straight to the happily ever after part, okay?
Junior could be anyone he wanted to be.
Frederick J. Fringer.
Herman Gottlieb.
I got something on the real Gottlieb.
You can call me Junior.
Mug, DOA at the San Francisco Airport Hospital.
Wouldn't use his real name.
Sergeant Hope Mosley, homicide. You ain't no cop. Oh, I'm a cop.
He's making arrests? Police raid, everybody freeze!
Maybe you should wait and let him solve a couple more for your caseload, huh?
Stop or I'll shoot! You just shot me!
Fired a warning shot and hit him.
Unfortunately, the person he decided to be wants Junior dead.
Hair trigger. Stole my gun, my badge, my teeth.
Now you stay out of crime.
I promise.
Police officer! Police!
Miami Blues.
Price check. Uzi squirt gun.
Be sure to join us next week when we cover George Armitage's Miami Blues, where we'll be joined by author Scott Phillips. As they say in the 1950s, it'll be a gas.
And be sure to check out the official Projection Booth website at projection-booth.com. We'll have links. You can find out more about The Ghastly Love of Johnny X, where it might be playing a festival near you since it's still on the festival circuit, when it may be coming out on DVD or some other sundry format. Also, make sure to stop by that site. Leave us some way cool feedback, Daddy-O, and head over to iTunes and leave us some feedback there. Star us there, because that's a big help for us here in the podcast world of Projection Booth. And as they say, let's rumble, Daddy-O.
Here we go. Baby, we're on our way.
Driving across the desert just to have some fun.
Here we go. Baby, we're on our way.
Driving up to Vegas, gonna have some fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna shoot some craps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and play roulette perhaps.
Tearing up the town until we all collapse.
Cause firstly and lastly, there ain't no more ghastly one.
Are you brain damaged or drunk? We're on the air.